man who died yesterday.
Yes. So overall, within the context of conditions, like I said before, the private facilities lack transparency. The Attorney General of California actually has a mandate to be able to investigate the conditions of these facilities, and they were actually denied access in their initial inquiry into the private detention facilities in California. So again, we've seen that there's a lack of accountability and transparency in these facilities, which lead to things like deaths in detention, people suffering. And so this bill, again, will remove the for-profit incentive from these companies in running these facilities, and hopefully that results in less people being detained within the context of these for-profit facilities and overall less people dying in these facilities.
Well, I want to thank you very much for being with us. Of course, we'll continue to follow this and whether or not the governor signs this ban on for-profit prisons. Hamid Yazdan Panah is an immigration attorney with the California Collaborative for Immigrant Justice. That does it for our broadcast here in San Francisco. We'll be here again tomorrow. Nermeen Sheikh will be speaking tonight in Ithaca, New York at 7 o'clock. Check our website at democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Dina Guzder, Nermeen Sheikh, Carla Wills, Tammy Warrenoff, Libby Rainey, Sam Alkoff, John Hamilton, Robbie Karen, Hani Massoud, Tarina Nadura, Tamarie Astudio, Maria Tarasena, and Dennis Moynihan. Mike DeFilippo and Miguel Nagera are engineers. Special thanks to Becca Staley and Miriam Barnard, Julie Crosby, Hugh Grand, David Prude, Ishmael Darrow, Vesta Gadars, Karl Marxer. I'm Amy Goodman here in San Francisco. Thanks so much for joining us.
This is Ursula K. Le Guin, and you are listening to KBOO, the cheerful voice of social conscience, KBOO, Portland.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available by calling the station at 503-231-8032. Meetings will be held at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, unless otherwise noted. The Engineering Committee meets on the first Thursday of the month at 7 p.m. Please join us. KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programs.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Poll Disclosure on Friday, October 4th from 4 to 7:30 p.m. at the AWOL Dance Collective Space in Portland. Poll Disclosure is a full-length circus theater show using aerial acrobatics as a conduit for storytelling. The artists will unfold the story of two women and their journeys through healthy and unhealthy relationships featuring live, original cello music. The artists will hold space after the show for discussion. Again, that's Poll Disclosure, Friday, October 4th from 4 to 7:30 p.m. at the AWOL Dance Collective Space, 513 Northeast Schuyler Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, a shooter attacks at least three people in a downtown Vancouver retirement community.
Childhood obesity in Oregon is on the rise.
And rent assistance, is it the way to keep hundreds of thousands of Oregonians in their homes?
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, October 3rd, 2019. I'm Annette Newell.
And I'm Althea Billings. One person is dead and two others injured in a shooting in downtown Vancouver senior living establishment. The suspect is a resident of the Smith Tower Apartments, and the Columbian reports that the suspect is an 80-year-old white male with a hat, glasses, and a beard, wearing a tan and blue jacket. The incident was reported just after 2 p.m., and the shooter remained in the building, barricaded in his apartment until 4:50 p.m. when he was taken into custody. A source has informed KBOO that, contrary to earlier reports, the building had not been evacuated, and instead many residents were still in shelter in place. Police were seen carrying the wounded out of the building and warned passersby to stay away from the area as there may have been a shooting risk through the windows. The Smith Tower website describes the apartment building as a retirement community for people age 62 and older, located at 5th and Washington Street in Vancouver.
Polk County's district attorney has announced that a grand jury decided the use of force by a Dallas police officer that killed 43-year-old Scott Spangler was justified. The grand jury's decision means they think criminal prosecution is not warranted and that the use of deadly force against Mr. Spangler by Dallas officer Darren Buchholz was a lawful act of self-defense or defense of a third person. This investigation started on September 18th following the report of an officer-involved shooting with members of the Polk Narcotics Team. The Salem Police conducted the investigation, and the Polk County District Attorney's Office presented the evidence to the grand jury. In making this decision, the grand jury heard from detectives and officers from Salem Police, deputies from the Polk County Sheriff's Office, the involved officers, and six citizen witnesses.
Jeremy Christian's lawyers are trying to make sure he does not get the death penalty. The man police charged with killing two people on a Portland light rail train in 2017 have filed a motion to have the death penalty removed as an option. The lawyers also asked that the two counts of aggravated murder be dismissed because they say the law no longer applies since the state changed the definition of aggravated murder. Investigators accused Christian of stabbing three men on a MAX train when a fight broke out over alleged hate speech that he was directing at two young women on the train. One of the men survived. Christian pled not guilty. Oregon lawmakers changed the definition of aggravated murder this year with Senate Bill 1013, which went into effect in September. It is the state's only criminal charge that carries a potential death sentence. With the new law, aggravated murder only applies for the premeditated murders of children under 14, murders of law enforcement officers, terrorist attacks that kill at least two people, and prison killings carried out by someone who'd previously been convicted of murder.
The Great Oregon Shakeout Earthquake Drill is coming up. It's the world's largest earthquake drill on October 17th at 10:17 in the morning. So state emergency managers want you to think about what you would do during an earthquake. More than 600,000 Oregonians are already registered at shakeout.org. Oregon and Washington are right in the heart of earthquake country. In 1993 alone, Western Oregon experienced two damaging earthquakes at Scotts Mills and Klamath Falls. They damaged a high school and the state capitol building. And there is evidence that a massive subduction zone earthquake will happen off the coast somewhere between Northern California to British Columbia, with force similar to that which hit Indonesia in 2004 and Japan in 2011. Great shakeout earthquake drills are an opportunity to practice how to be safer during earthquakes by knowing how to drop, cover, and hold on. Now, here's some advice on what to do if an earthquake strikes while you're asleep.
Never get out of bed during shaking. Some of the most common injuries following an earthquake are tripping on items that have moved or cutting your feet on broken glass or other objects. Before the next earthquake, keep a pair of shoes and a flashlight in a bag tied to your bed so that the bag does not move during shaking, making it easy for you to access it when the shaking is over. The bag will also prevent broken glass or other objects from getting into your shoes. If you are in a bed and feel shaking, turn onto your stomach. Protect your head and neck with a pillow. Be sure to place your hands on the part of the pillow that covers your head and neck. Close your eyes and mouth to protect against dust and debris. After the shaking is over, wait a moment and check all around and above you before getting up or leaving your bed.
Some good advice there. Now, shakeout organizers say that to react quickly, you have to practice often. You may only have seconds to protect yourself in an earthquake before strong shaking knocks you down or drops something on you. Now, to learn more about earthquakes in Oregon and how to prepare, visit the oregon.gov website and search on earthquakes.
A shirtless woman took a mail truck on a joyride today in Portland. Police say the woman stole a U.S. Postal Service truck and took it for a ride and crashed it into a passenger bus and then kept going. Later on, she flipped the truck, coming out shirtless, then led officers on a 12-block foot chase. Officers responded to the Centennial neighborhood just after noon today to reports of a stolen mail truck. The woman smashed into a TriMet paratransit Lyft bus. TriMet says three people were on board but not seriously injured. The woman drove north on Northeast 162nd Avenue for another mile before flipping the truck and crashing near Northeast 155th Avenue and Fremont Street. Officers chased the woman and caught her in the Wilkes neighborhood. The woman was not hurt, but emergency workers took her to a hospital. Gresham Police and the United States Postal Inspector are helping with the investigation.
Following Wednesday's alarming reports about a multi-million dollar drug trafficking bust between Oregon and Mexico, additional details have come out. Operatives in Portland were filing orders weekly for more than 600,000 individual doses of cocaine, heroin, and meth. Included in the $15 million trafficking charges, alleged reports of illegal firearms have been added, shipped from Oregon to Mexico between inside associates. Routine changes in stash houses, delivery vehicles, phones, and individual couriers aided the organization from avoiding detection. Recent court documents revealed a sophisticated money laundering scheme based out of a Mexican mini-mart. With knowledge and consent, the owners of this market allowed drug proceeds to be wired in small amounts back to Mexico. Estimates of about $1 million a year were laundered through this establishment alone. Federal authorities have credited the Gresham Police Department for first bringing the drug ring to their attention. Gresham Police Chief Robin Sells says her detectives were tipped off from a confidential source. The top two suspected leaders remain at large following their indictments.
A Washington State grassroots immigration group is celebrating at least one victory. As Eric Tegedoff reports, community-to-community development helped pass legislation in Washington this year that provides more oversight to a federal guest worker program.
A unique grassroots organization that supports immigrant and farm workers' rights in Washington state is celebrating 15 years of fighting back. Community-to-community development is holding its 15th anniversary in Bellingham, highlighting some of its accomplishments over the past decade and a half. Liz Darrow with the group says C2C has helped families after immigration raids, supported the nation's first indigenous-led farm workers union, Familias Unidas por la Justicia, and pushed state legislation that created an oversight board for a federal guest farm worker program. But she notes that C2C often has to go around the existing power structure to accomplish its goals.
When people create change for themselves and by themselves, it's a lot more impactful and it's a lot more sustainable. So that's the silver lining of not having power structures on your side, is that you can make the road by walking, so to speak.
Darrow says the group has plenty of work to do, and chief among its concerns is the climate crisis. The anniversary event, called Making the Road by Walking, is on Friday at 5 p.m. at Boundary Bay Brewery. The name of the event refers to a poem by Antonio Machado. Political director for Familias Unidas por la Justicia, Edgar Franks, says his union would not have been as successful without C2C's support. He adds that the group, which he used to intern for, has seen farm workers through a lot and still plays a vital role in communities.
With the attacks on immigrants and on workers, stock market crashes, and what have you that has happened in the last 15 years, C2C has always been able to maintain in the community and be the voice for some of the people that have been forgotten about or marginalized.
Kara Black partners with C2C through the Bellingham Unitarian Fellowship. She's watched the group grow in power over the past 15 years and says it's a rare type of grassroots organization.
It's led by women of color. It's led by people who've been where the people are that they're working to support. It's not an organization you find everywhere, and it's really actually an honor to be able to participate with this organization and to support this organization.
For Public News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
Portland area law enforcement and community members are teaming up for the fourth annual Building Bridges of Understanding in Our Communities event. It's coming up on October 24th. This year's theme is Confronting Hate. This event brings criminal justice and community leaders together to share perspectives and discuss how to respond to and prevent hate-motivated incidents and crimes. A diverse panel will discuss personal and community experiences with hate-motivated incidents and crimes, reporting, and trauma. Presenters include leaders and experts from the Western States Center, Portland United Against Hate, Coalitions of Communities of Color, Coalition Against Hate Crimes, the FBI, and many others. They're going to present information reviewing recent racial violence trends and data from our community, as well as legal and enforcement efforts at the local, state, and federal levels. Community members from Multnomah, Clackamas, and Washington counties are encouraged to attend this free event. Registration is required. Lunch and refreshments will be provided. The Building Bridges of Understanding in Our Communities Confronting Hate meeting is coming up Thursday, October 4th from 8:30 a.m. to 3 p.m. at the Muslim Educational Trust Building in Tigard.
The Portland Marathon is scheduled to be run Sunday morning, prompting bridge and traffic lane closures and potentially long delays for traffic and pedestrians. Bridges affected include the Broadway Bridge, the Burnside Bridge, the Morrison Bridge, the Selwood Bridge, and the St. John's Bridge. Several freeway ramps will also be affected, with the I-5 northbound exit 302C closing at 5 a.m. until 2 p.m. For a complete list of street, road, and bridge closures, as well as the revised marathon course, please visit the marathon's website online at www.portlandmarathon.com. Portland streetcar and TriMet users are urged to plan ahead, as many MACs and bus lines will face reroutes and delays. Further information on these disruptions may also be found online at trimet.org or by calling 503-238-RIDE. The race consists of both a full and a half marathon, both beginning at 7:10 a.m. Held annually since 1972, the Portland Marathon is one of the longest-running consecutive marathons in the U.S., with an expected attendance of over 10,000 participants for 2019.
Childhood obesity is on the rise across the country and right here in our state by more than 11% in Oregon, according to a recent report. Experts say healthy eating habits are critical to stopping this trend. KBOO's Annie Maher has the story.
To combat rising obesity rates among children, experts say healthy eating habits are key. One program aiming to put kids on track for healthier food choices is Food Roots in Tillamook County, which partners with 6 schools in the area. Its farm-to-school program manager, Rachel Pettit, says one approach they use to encourage better diet decisions among students is to introduce judgment-free opportunities to try new vegetables. As she puts it, not yucking someone's yum can help break down the stigma around healthy foods.
When you say that what someone else is eating is gross, that really can hurt someone else's feelings and have a negative impact on how they view themselves or how they view what they're eating.
Food Roots receives support from the local coordinated care organization, Columbia Pacific CCO. In Oregon, more than 1 in 10 children between ages 10 and 17 is considered obese, according to the latest report from the Trust for America's Health. Kristen Case is nurse practitioner manager for Multnomah County Student Health Centers and says 30-50% of the patients they see are considered obese. The centers are located at high schools across the county, serving kids ages 5 to 18, regardless of whether their families have health insurance. Case says she is seeing diabetes diagnosed at younger ages and notes other long-term health effects, from hypertension and liver disease to an association with mental health conditions. She offers advice to parents for healthier eating.
This sounds super simple, but I think it's really important is if families can sit down together for a meal and families helping to choose healthy options that are in the house, being a good role model.
For Pettit, helping kids choose healthy options at school has translated to change outside the classroom. She's heard from parents who say their kids were picky eaters, but after a taste test with Food Roots, they want to eat vegetables.
That really shows to us that what we're doing is positively impacting these youth and is making its way home.
For KBOO Evening News and the Oregon News Service, I'm Annie Maher.
A Corvallis doctor is suing Oregon Health and Science University for violating terms regarding the usage of his sperm donation. Dr. Bryce Cleary donated sperm in 1989 during his first year as a student at OHSU for research and for women wanting to conceive. Cleary says he agreed to donate after the university promised him his sperm would not be used to conceive more than 5 children, that his donation would remain anonymous, and that the women would not live anywhere near Oregon or the Pacific Northwest. However, in 2015, 2 women found out they were sisters through information found on Ancestry.com. Further information found on Ancestry.com and through OHSU's fertility clinic named Cleary as their biological father. After the women contacted Cleary directly, his research on the popular family history site revealed several more children he had unknowingly fathered, most of whom were conceived in Oregon. To date, Cleary has learned his sperm was used to father at least 17 children, and he wonders if there may be more. He is suing OHSU for unethical breach of its assurances and for moral and emotional distress these breaches have incurred on the Cleary family. An earlier lawsuit in 2006 also cited OHSU's fertility clinic as mistakenly giving the wrong woman a sperm donation. The clinic acknowledged that mistake but is withholding comment on Cleary's pending case.
Pacific Core, the Portland-based electric company that serves almost 2 million customers in the western U.S., announced a plan today that would retire most of its coal plants over the next 20 years. The company has 2 subsidiaries. One is Pacific Power, which serves Oregon, Washington, and California. The other is Rocky Mountain Power for Utah, Idaho, and Wyoming. The company's plan calls for larger investments in renewable energy, such as wind and solar. Pacific Core currently uses 24 coal units. Now, under this plan, it will close 16 of those by 2030 and another 4 by 2038. This morning, the company recognized these closures will affect people's jobs. Chad Tepley, the company's senior vice president for business policy and development, says, quote, "We are mindful that these resource decisions impact our thermal operations employees, their families, and communities. Our top priority is making certain our employees and communities remain informed about the changes ahead and that we work in concert with everyone involved to develop plans that help them transition through this time of change. End of quote.
The global food system could be the cause of more than a third of human-induced greenhouse gas emissions. KBOO's Jeffrey Wade explains how natural farming solutions could reduce the climate impact of food.
As climate change takes center stage, a think tank, the Institute for Agriculture and Trade Policy, says we should take a hard look at how our food system is driving the crisis. According to a report last year from the United Nations Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, the global food system could be responsible for as much as 37% of human-induced greenhouse gas emissions. Shefali Sharma, director of the Institute for Agriculture and Trade Policy's European office, says governments subsidize products such as feed for factory farms, driving up emissions and forcing farms to get big or get out. She notes recent government aid to struggling farmers is due to trade policies and the low cost of production set by big agriculture.
The reason the subsidy system is in place in the first place is because very few companies set a price at artificially low costs. And so if we stopped doing that, we wouldn't have to have the subsidies. And I think most farmers would say we'd rather be paid the cost of production plus a reasonable profit rather than having to take this.
Shefali says the recent farm bill subsidized feed such as corn and soy, which benefits industrial farms. She notes that just 9 countries, including the United States, produce and export the vast majority of the world's beef, pork, chicken, and dairy, and that these countries could redirect public resources away from farm corporations to natural solutions to climate change, such as regenerative agriculture. The Institute for Agriculture and Trade Policy also says governments should better regulate meat and dairy corporations' supply chain emissions, including hazards, such as the overabundance of nitrates, and that those corporations should shoulder the costs. Shefali says ultimately what is needed to empower farmers, workers, and consumers is a just transition to regenerative agriculture, which rejuvenates soil and reduces emissions.
The climate emergency is requiring us to decentralize, to have decentralized solutions, which means local food hubs, and we see the rise of that movement in the United States.
While these solutions are straightforward, Shefali says big agriculture has an outsized influence on policymaking. But she maintains a shift in policies is coming and has been inspired by young people's commitment to tackling climate change. For KBOO Evening News, I'm Jeffrey Wade.
Higher temperatures in the future could have a negative impact on corn and soybean production in rural areas and public health in urban communities. As Mary Sherman reports, a new survey shows about 7 in 10 adults believe climate change is impacting the United States.
As Ohioans swept through record high October temperatures this week, new polling suggests many people are connecting the dots between extreme weather and climate change. The 2019 Ohio Health Issues poll, released by Interact for Health, found that 7 in 10 Ohio adults believe global warming is affecting the United States either somewhat or a great deal, and 6 in 10 said global warming is affecting their local community. These effects are becoming more apparent, according to Ryan Mooney Bullock with Green Umbrella, a Cincinnati-based organization working to increase environmental sustainability.
We've been having 90-degree weather in September and October this year. That is not normal for our region. Instead of having a 100-year storm every 100 years, we're getting many in one season. We had a bit of a drought this summer, but this spring and early summer was some of the wettest on record.
According to the EPA, high temperatures in the future are expected to result in reduced corn and soybean production in rural areas and increased public health issues in urban communities. Opinions on climate change varied by political affiliation, with Democrats more likely than Republicans or Independents to believe that climate change has an impact on their nation and or their community. However, Mooney Bullock believes the tide is shifting.
We obviously have had a fluctuating political environment in the country in terms of what the United States' commitments to reducing greenhouse gas emissions are. But I think everyday people here in the heartland are concerned about climate change and want to do something about it.
Mooney Bullock admits it can be daunting for people to know how to start taking steps to address climate change, so she encourages involvement in community-level efforts to increase sustainability.
There's lots of ways to get involved, not only at home, but at work. A place of worship can be a great way to kind of tackle these issues because everybody working together, these small solutions, these incremental changes really do make a difference.
According to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, The health effects of climate change can include increased respiratory and cardiovascular disease, injuries, and premature death. For Public News Service, I'm Mary Sherman.
Advocates are bringing attention to the need for disabled people to be included in climate change discussions. Dr. Anthony Lazowitz has more on the story with Climate Connections.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lazowitz, and this is Climate Connections. The United States is home to tens of millions of people with disabilities.
It's, depending on how you define it, anywhere from 12 to even 20% of the population. And as we have an aging population, that number is going to get higher.
That's Alex Guinness of the World Institute on Disability. He says that as people work to limit global warming and respond to the impacts, they sometimes overlook the needs of this large and growing population.
Within the environmental community, I think that there's just this kind of inherent assumption of ableism.
For example, a small energy-efficient house may not include wide doorways or a roll-in shower, so it may not accommodate someone with physical disabilities who uses a wheelchair. And though riding a bicycle or growing food can help reduce carbon pollution, not everyone can participate in these activities. So Guinness says climate and disability rights activists should work together to shape a low-carbon future that includes the needs of people with disabilities.
There's got to be, I think, better communication, better partnership, better empathy and understanding, and collaboration toward creating a healthier environment that still supports everybody.
Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. Learn more at yaleclimateconnections.org.
Salmon are a marker for how we treat our environment. That's what Commissioner Nick Fish said during a Portland City Council meeting Wednesday. A salmon restoration project in Crystal Springs has drawn international acclaim by becoming a finalist for this year's C40 Cities Bloomberg Philanthropies Awards. Wild coho salmon have recently reemerged over the past 5 years at Crystal Springs after decades of their disappearing. The Crystal Springs project began in 2008 in order to protect salmon under the Endangered Species Act. Salmon now travel through Crystal Springs to spawn again. Winners of the Bloomberg Awards will be announced in October on the 10th in Copenhagen, Denmark. Mayor Ted Wheeler plans to attend the C40 World Mayors Summit.
A dozen restaurants along the West Coast are closing due to Seattle-based Restaurants Unlimited recent bankruptcy and sale. It filed for Chapter 11 bankruptcy in July when it had closed two local restaurants, the Lloyd District's Prime Rib and Chocolate Cake and the Portland Seafood Grill. Last week, a U.S. bankruptcy court approved the $37.2 million sale of Restaurants Unlimited to Landry's. The Houston-based dining giant was able to pick up the properties it wanted to keep, including the Portland City Grill. In Oregon, Salem's Newport Seafood Grill joined the previously reported closures of Pearl District Tap Room, Henry's Tavern, and the two Portland locations of the Stanford's restaurant chain. A Washington company has picked the three remaining Portland area Stanford's locations in North Portland, Clackamas, and Hillsboro, as well as the Portland Seafood Grill at Mall 205. Landry's is taking over at Henry's PDX, Portland City Grill, and Stanford's Cruise and Manzana, which are both in Lake Oswego.
The National Park Service is planning to allow all-terrain vehicles, such as ATVs, to travel access roads and back roads in Utah parks beginning in November. As you might imagine, Mark Richardson reports some groups are opposed to this plan.
The peace and quiet of the back roads in many of Utah's national parks soon could be interrupted by the roar of all-terrain vehicles. Utah conservation groups say a recent memo from the National Park Service directed Utah park superintendents, starting in November, to allow the vehicles known as ATVs or UTVs to travel on the same access roads and back roads as cars, trucks, and SUVs. Neil Clark with the Southern Utah Wilderness Alliance says it's a very bad idea.
Just a terribly short-sighted decision from the administration. They're off-road vehicles. They're intended to be used off-road, and they're just completely contrary to the purpose of the parks and why people visit and cherish them.
The memo instructs the parks to follow a 2008 Utah law that allows the state's more than 200,000 licensed off-road vehicles to travel on state and county roads. The Park Service says any vehicle traveling off the roads would be issued a citation. The new rule only applies in parks in Utah, but conservationists fear the changes could eventually spread to other states. Clark Clark says in his experience, if off-road vehicles are allowed in the park, many drivers would likely venture into prohibited areas despite the regulations. He adds that park rangers chasing them down to issue a ticket would do additional damage to the park. He believes the decision will be a nightmare for park maintenance, wildlife, and the environment.
We've certainly seen UTV use in southern Utah rapidly increase over the years. We see a correlated increase in illegal use and destruction of natural resources. There's certainly a correlated environmental impact when you unleash these machines.
Off-road vehicles were previously barred from most national parks in Utah, but after years of lobbying by off-road groups and lawmakers, Park Service is changing its policy. Clark says the change is being made without any notice or opportunity for public comment. He says his group and other organizations are considering legal action to stop the move. For Public News Service, I'm Mark Richardson.
The number of older adults will dramatically increase over the next 10 years. You can learn about the importance of engaging older adults at the next meeting of the Commission on Aging at 4:30 p.m. Wednesday, October 16th in Vancouver. The meeting will be held on the 6th floor hearing room of the Public Service Center at 1300 Franklin Street. Brenda Wood, Employment Specialist for the Goodwill Senior Community Service Employment Program, will talk about how older adults' knowledge, talent, skills, and experience and wisdom can provide a positive and powerful impact. Colleen Kuhn, Executive Director of the Human Services Council, will discuss how senior volunteers are critical in providing needed support to local organizations and why remaining socially engaged improves their quality of life. The October 16th discussion is the 7th meeting this year focusing on healthy communities, especially for people 65 and older. The Commission on Aging in Clark County is a 9-member volunteer group that implements the Aging Readiness Plan and provides leadership. For more about the commission, please visit www.clark.wa.gov/aging.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for an in-depth report on rent assistance. Is it time for this solution to Oregon's housing crisis? At 6, we've got Rose City Native Radio coming up. Then at 7, Hard Knock Radio. Tonight's weather, it's going to be cloudy out there with occasional rain showers, a low of 48 degrees. Tomorrow, it's going to be overcast with rain showers at times, a high of 61. And today in history, on this date in 1873, Captain Jack and three other Modoc natives were hanged in Oregon for the murder of General Edward Canby, the only general killed during the Indian Wars. Our quote of the day is from Captain Jack, who asked Canby to give us a home in our country. When Canby said he didn't have the authority to make such a promise, Captain Jack attacked the general.
In the 2020 presidential election race, some candidates are raking in much more cash than others. Lily Bolke takes a closer look at who's leading and who's lagging.
We decided about 2 weeks ago to chart a pretty unusual path forward. We wanted to give an unvarnished look at the reality of what it takes to fund a presidential campaign.
That was Adisu Demissi, campaign manager for New Jersey Senator Cory Booker. The senator is still in the running for president after a cliffhanger of a fundraising appeal. The campaign successfully raised $1.7 million in the days before the end of the September cutoff, after letting supporters know Booker would drop out otherwise. Third quarter fundraising numbers are coming out ahead of the mid-October Federal Election Commission filing deadline. The financial snapshots give an indication of the more popular candidates. Ahead of 2020, 6 of the more than 20 presidential candidates have out-fundraised the rest, but one more so than any other. Here's Brendan Quinn of the Center for Responsive Politics.
President Trump, he made the unusual move of filing for re-election the day of his inauguration, which is somewhat unprecedented. So he's had quite a bit more time to raise money, because he's technically been raising money for 2020 since January of 2017. In terms of the Democrats, we do have 5 candidates who are vastly outraising their opponents. That's former Vice President Joe Biden, Senators Elizabeth Warren, Bernie Sanders, and Kamala Harris, and South Bend Mayor Pete Buttigieg.
Those 5 have qualified for the November Democratic debate. 12 will be at the October 15th contest in Cleveland. All on one night, the most presidential candidates ever to share the stage. Candidates have many methods of fundraising, some with limits on contributions, like campaign committees, which pull from individuals and political action committees, or PACs. This election cycle, the maximum an individual can give is $800, and the max for a PAC is $5,000. There are also super PACs that can contribute unlimited funds. Corporations can't give to campaign committees, but they can give to super PACs.
For campaign committees and super PACs, that money is required to be disclosed.
However, contributions from nonprofit organizations and trade associations are often called dark money because
they are not required to disclose their donors. We also see these groups giving significantly to super PACs as well.
So, very powerful funders can hide what eventually goes to super PACs. In recent years, candidates have started to draw lines for themselves when it comes to campaign fundraising to avoid the appearance that they're beholden to certain interests.
A lot of people, last cycle and this cycle, especially on the Democratic side, are rejecting any money from corporate PACs.
But despite campaign finance regulations, money seems to have a way of working through the system even without corporate PACs. In the first year of the 2016 election cycle, there was 10 times as much dark money as there was in 2012. From Pacifica Network and Public News Service, I'm Lily Bolke.
The Justice Department renewed its fight for access to encrypted communications today as Attorney General William Barr took aim at Facebook's plan to make WhatsApp more secure. Barr has been pressing Facebook CEO Mark Zuckerberg to create a backdoor in its end-to-end encryption for tech for law enforcement to access, arguing that this is a vital crime-fighting tool. Tech companies and advocates have argued that doing so would threaten individual privacy. Zuckerberg said of their encryption technology, quote, "The future of communication will increasingly shift to private encrypted services where people can be confident what they say to each other stays secure, and their messages and content won't stick around forever." Now, this new push comes today as the New York Times Magazine published an article about ICE operations in the Pacific Northwest. This article details how officers would embed themselves into a community and use both government data and personal data collected and sold by tech companies to track undocumented immigrants, even ones who were not a priority.
Stormwater and sewage shouldn't mix, but they often do. With more on this water management, it's Current Cast.
Stormwater and sewage on this Current Cast. In many parts of Pittsburgh, stormwater and sewage are carried in the same pipes. So during heavy rain, the system can overflow and dump untreated sewage directly into the city's rivers.
As we get more and more rain, it just is an outdated way of managing the flow of stormwater, and it's just disgusting.
That's Stefan Bontrager of the nonprofit Riverlife. He says to better protect the rivers and people's health, the city is working to upgrade its aging infrastructure. Pittsburgh is also partnering with nonprofits and landowners to restore watersheds and plant rain gardens.
So that you can capture a lot of that storm water before it ever even hits the sewer system.
Current Cast, produced with Cornell's Atkinson Center for a Sustainable Future and made possible by the Foundation for Pennsylvania Watersheds. Online at currentcast.org.
A $500,000 settlement is in the works over Alaska police accused of not properly investigating a rape report. With that story and much more, here's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News, the daily newscast dedicated to Indigenous news, issues, and culture.
The city of Nome, Alaska, has yet to respond to settlement demands from the ACLU over allegations the city's police failed to properly investigate a former dispatcher's rape report. City officials met in executive session this week to discuss the ACLU's offer to settle the case on behalf of Clarice Bunn Hardy for $500,000. KNOM's Emily Hofstetter reports.
Megan Edge, the communications director for ACLU Alaska, says that Hardy was not just traumatized by the assault, but re-traumatized by her experience with the Nome police. Edge says Hardy deserves justice and compensation, but for the ACLU, this is about more than justice for Clarice Hardy.
We are also really hoping and striving to ensure that all Alaska Native people and Alaska Native women are ensured their equal rights as protected and guaranteed by the constitutions of the United States and Alaska.
Interim City Manager John Handelin confirmed that he did receive the ACLU's demands, but will not comment on any particular matter or investigation. The current police chief says he refers all questions about Hardy's case to the district attorney and state troopers. Hardy has been public about being sexually assaulted in March of 2017. Part of that encounter was allegedly recorded on Snapchat and viewed by Hardy and several friends. She says she immediately made a written report to her then colleague, Lieutenant Nick Harvey.
I followed up and would ask him how the investigation was going. And every time that I would ask, I'd get the same answer as to, I'm still working on it, bud.
That's Hardy speaking with KNOM earlier this year about the incident. The ACLU claims that Lieutenant Harvey's failure to do a thorough investigation has resulted in, quote, the loss of corroborative, objective evidence of Ms. Hardy's allegations. The ACLU has given the city until October 11th to accept the offer of settlement with Clarice Hardy. Reporting in Nome, I'm Emily Hofstetter.
Montana's Bighorn County will establish a task force to investigate missing persons cases following the death of a Native girl. Olivia Reingold has more.
Bighorn County Attorney Jay Harris says he's forming a task force to address suspicious deaths and missing persons cases. Harris, an enrolled Crow tribal member, announced the decision less than 2 weeks after marchers stood outside the Bighorn County Courthouse demanding action on the death of Kay Sarah Stops Pretty Places, an Indigenous girl whose body was found in a hardened backyard this August shortly after her 18th birthday. In a press release, Harris says that Bighorn County, which includes part of the Crow and Northern Cheyenne Nations, finds itself in unprecedented times because of methamphetamine use and distribution. There are currently 5 missing persons cases being investigated by the Bighorn County Sheriff's Office on the Montana Missing Persons Clearinghouse website. Harris says the task force will supervise the conduct of the Bighorn County Sheriff's Office and County Coroner during suspicious deaths and homicide cases. He says the first meeting will be next week. For National Native News, I'm Olivia Reingold in Billings, Montana.
The Premier of Quebec apologized to Indigenous people Wednesday at the National Assembly, the CBC reports. The apology follows the release of a report which found discrimination between Indigenous people and public service agencies. Premier François Legault apologized in a speech in French to First Nations and Inuit people. The report lays out more than 100 recommendations, which the Premier says he will study and work on with Indigenous groups. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
Just days after House Democrats announced an official impeachment inquiry into President Trump and his dealings with Ukraine, today the president has openly urged global rival China to investigate former Vice President Joe Biden and his son. At the White House today, Trump said, quote, China should start an investigation into the Bidens. While Chinese President Xi Jinping was not one of the foreign leaders that the president had previously asked for investigation help, Trump said it is, quote, certainly something we could start thinking about. According to federal law, it is a violation of campaign finance regulation for anyone to solicit, accept, or receive anything of value from a foreign nation in connection to a U.S. election. This public call to China echoes that which Trump made to Russia during the 2016 presidential campaign, asking the foreign power to find Hillary Clinton's emails. According to the Associated Press, this bold tactic is one that the president has used before, pushing questionable secret conversations into the open and helping to shield against charges that he is engaged in any sort of cover-up. Biden campaign chairman Cedric Richmond dismissed Trump's comments, saying, quote, this president is scared and he's acting out.
Experts say no one should just be a bystander when it comes to bullying. As Eric Tegedoff tells us, this October is Bullying Prevention Month.
October is National Bullying Prevention Month, bringing awareness to this issue's growing impact on students. According to the 2019 Montana Youth Risk Behavior Survey, 22% of students across the state say they've been bullied on campus, and nearly 18% say they've been bullied online. Holly Mook, the Coordinated School Health Unit Director with the Montana Office of Public Instruction, says no one should be a bystander to bullying.
We can't turn a blind eye to it. We can't act like it's not going on. That doesn't help anybody. It creates more damage than good. If you see something, say something.
Montana schools are required to have bullying prevention plans. Mook says her office provides a toolkit to schools to help them develop and update their plans. Mook says there are a number of resources available to parents as well. The Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration has the No Bullying app. There's also StopBullying.gov from the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. Mook says these resources help parents answer questions about bullying and can even let them know if something more serious is going on, including civil rights issues.
A lot of times you'll have parents that say, am I overreacting or am I underreacting? These different resources kind of help them navigate what those signs and symptoms look like and how they can intervene.
She notes the Montana Department of Justice provides the Safe in Your Space program to students, parents, and schools to teach them about online safety and cyberbullying. For Public News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, October 3rd, 2019. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories and tips at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast includes Jeffrey Wade, Annie Maher, and Janiah Boyer. The producer is Annette Newell, and our engineer is Jeff Henderson. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Althea Billings.
And I'm Annette Newell. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO at 8, we've got Sojourner Truth Radio. At 9, it's part one of a four-part radio documentary, Holding the Thin Green Line, hosted by Barbara Bernstein. The first part will discuss efforts in Tacoma, Washington, to stop the world's largest methanol refinery from being built at the port. At 10, it's Madness Radio, Voices and Visions from Outside Mental Health. At 10:30, it's Film at 1, discussing the new movie Raise Hell, The Life and Times of Molly Ivins. Then at 11, it's Pacific Underground. All of these KBOO programs are made possible by member support. And if you'd like to become a member, we invite you to go to kboo.fm or use our mobile app and click on Donate. Now stay with us for KBOO News In Depth coming up next. Basically, the theme of your research is rent assistance works. That was the key finding, the key takeaway, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And so we've put out two research projects. The first...
Basically, the theme of your research is rent assistance works. That was the key finding, the key takeaway, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And so we've put out two research projects. The first really dug into what the benefits are from a rent assistance program and how it can help low-income communities afford the rent, can help children have stronger outcomes later in life, and how Oregon really desperately needs to invest in a statewide rent assistance program. And then we also came out with a product that was called Rent Assistance Works that really went into some of the ways that rent assistance really helps people achieve stable and affordable housing and addresses some of the concerns that folks have raised about rent assistance programs.
A state economist just announced rent increases are going to be capped at 9.9% through 2020. That's the first full year of Oregon's new rent control law that will be in effect. What do you think about that cap? Is that going to hurt or help the housing crisis that we're seeing?
I think the cap of 9.9% that was put in place to protect tenants from economic evictions is the right choice. It's important that we prevent really dramatic increases in year-over-year rents while still allowing folks that have invested in housing and own housing to make a reasonable return on their investments. And so where it's at right now is a level that I think there can be some debate on whether it should be higher or lower. But what we do know is that it's at a level that allows some profits while still ensuring that Oregon families aren't being gouged too heavily.
On almost 10% increase, on the surface would seem kind of high, though, don't you think? Because most people don't get 10% raises at their jobs, right, a year.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's why, I mean, the program that was put in place is not rent control. It's not a program that actually is intended to keep the rents close to wage growth. It's simply a program to prevent people from being evicted by really dramatic price increases. And so what we found in our research is that the rent stabilization work that was done is one part of many faceted strategy we need to actually keep housing and rents affordable for Oregonians. We also need to expand the supply. We need more affordable units on the market so people have access to more units. But what our research really focused on was the fact that we also need to step into the market in a way where we're actually helping people who have low incomes afford that rent.
Do you think that a rent assistance program could actually push up rents, though? That's one of the concerns about it.
You know, what we've found is that generally across the research that we've looked at is that it's unlikely to see any real significant increases in the rents. And there's a couple reasons for that. I mean, one of them is that the rental market is a private market and there is competition. And so folks that are just driving up the rents as rapidly as they can will find that some of their renters might find more affordable units for other landlords. And also, you know, it is a type of program that will help people afford the rent for units that are out there right now, really focusing in on the fact that there's a human cost to our current unaffordability crisis, and that a program like this will really help address that.
Could rent assistance be a disincentive to work? That's another one of the arguments against it.
Yeah, what we found is that a lot of the research is somewhat mixed about what the impacts could be of disincentivizing work. And one of the reasons for that is, you know, if someone is receiving rent assistance support, they might now have the capacity and the income available to actually invest in education, invest in job training. And then there's also the longer term impacts on the labor market of investments in rent assistance, because what we've found and others have found in their research that rent assistance actually creates better educational outcomes and economic outcomes for children who are in households that receive rent assistance. And so really, when we look at the long-term impacts on the labor market, we expect that investing in rent assistance would provide really positive benefits.
What are some of the chief benefits that you see coming from a rent assistance program that we don't have right now?
Definitely the easiest one to point out is the fact that people will be able to afford their rent. Right? At its core, what we have is a situation where Oregonians have seen wage increases that have not kept up with rent increases. And so by providing a little subsidy to help people, you know, close that gap, people will be stably and consistently housed. Beyond that, though, there's a lot of really interesting findings pointing to rent assistance improving people's mental and physical health after receiving the subsidy, and also that children housed in these units have substantially better outcomes. And interestingly, some of the research has found that children of color actually receive even stronger benefits from investments in rent assistance.
You've mentioned research a couple of times. I wonder if you could point out some communities that have had successful rent assistance programs and they've seen an impact on homelessness going down.
It's interesting because a lot of the different programs that emphasize investments in rent assistance have many different beneficiaries and folks that are targeted. And so some communities have targeted investments in rent assistance that benefit survivors of domestic violence, and others have focused on investing in folks who have experienced homelessness. And really what's clear to me with Oregon considering a rent assistance program is that we need to consider what populations that we want to emphasize. We need to really tailor the program to our local needs. And if what we're seeing is that folks that are currently living on the streets would be best suited for rent assistance, then I think an investment where we're actually helping these people consistently and stably stay housed would be a tremendous benefit in our region. And in fact, the Multnomah County has recently completed a pilot evaluation of a local rent assistance program right here in the Portland-Multnomah County area that found that there was tremendous benefit of keeping people housed and helping them afford the necessities in their lives.
How would it work, essentially? I mean, would people be sent a check every month at a certain income level, or how is it structured?
A lot of the questions around how to best structure the program to work for Oregon are not answers that we came into this research with, and we really hope that we're able to engage communities and stakeholders in a conversation to answer those questions. But generally, a rent assistance program works in most cases, although there is some exclusions to that, works by asking people to contribute up to 30% of their income towards their housing costs, and then the housing authority or the state would then cover the remainder of their housing costs. And who would be prioritized, who would receive that benefit, really depends on the structure of the program. So in many cases, it's set for very low-income folks, people who make less than 30% of the median income in a an area, but really it's up to us to figure out what works best for our communities.
Yeah, and where would the money come from, essentially? Would there have to be a new tax for it, or how do you see that working?
We've also not decided in any form where the revenue should come from. But I will say that there's a lot of options and opportunities when looking at our tax code today, where we invest millions and, in fact, hundreds of millions of dollars in housing subsidies in our tax code that predominantly go to higher income and wealthier households. And so we're subsidizing folks' mansions at a time when we could instead be supporting folks just having a stable and affordable rental.
You're talking about real estate taxes?
I think the most egregious example is Oregon's connection to the mortgage interest deduction. The deduction itself mainly flows, 60% of the benefit goes to the richest 1 in 5, and we see hundreds of millions of dollars going out the door every budget period to the richest, 5% of households.
Yeah, but if you take away that tax deduction, that's not going to be very politically popular, I'm guessing, right?
That's one of the perks of being a research institute, is we can really focus in on what is good policy, what are the issues that best exemplify our Oregon values, and recommend those changes, and then work with partners to figure out the politics. I mean, what we've found is that Oregonians generally believe in tax fairness, believe that those who have the least should receive more support than those who have the most. And so as much as nationally conversations around the mortgage interest deduction have often been fraught, I really believe that Oregon's in a situation and has an opportunity where we can reassess what matches our values.
Okay. Anything else you would like to add that I haven't asked you about?
Great question. just to kind of wrap everything up, renters in Oregon are struggling to survive, let alone thrive in our communities. And long-term rent assistance has shown again and again that it's a proven and effective way to keep families safely and affordably housed. We have federal rent assistance programs that really help tens of thousands of Oregonians, and they make a big difference, but they're far short of the nearly 300,000 Oregonians that rent and are cost burdened. And so really, what our research found is that Oregon needs to fill that gap. Oregon needs to step up and create a statewide rent assistance program. Mm-hmm.
You mentioned also that the rent assistance program that most of us know about is the federal housing choice vouchers, and that already helps tens of thousands of Oregonians. However, you're saying that program falls short of meeting the need. How much of a gap is there between what's already out there and what is needed?
It partly depends on how you define the need. The housing choice voucher program only helps folks that make less than 50% of the area median income. And what we looked at was, what are all of the folks, regardless of their income, in Oregon who are renting and who are paying more than 30% of their income in housing costs? And that found that about 290,000 Oregonians, or Oregon households, were struggling to afford the rent at all income levels. And so if we look at that as the threshold, then the gap's, hundreds of thousands of units. Although we might want to, as a state, tone that back to where we are looking more explicitly at low-income folks that are cost-burdened rather than middle-class folks, although maybe they also need the support.
How much do you have to make in terms of a salary to afford a house here? I know that there's people who work for the city of Portland who say they can't afford to live here, for example.
Yeah, that's a great question, and I haven't looked at the research on home prices relative to incomes lately. I do know that some earlier research found that in many communities in Oregon that teachers and other folks working what many would consider middle-class jobs simply couldn't afford to buy a house in their own community where they're teaching or where they're working. And that's something that we have found again and again, is that Oregon has an affordability crisis that's unique to each region of the state, but that's present in every region of the state.
And in the meantime, you've done all this work about rent assistance. What happens with all this information that you collected? Where does it go next, and how do you hope it's going to be applied to help people?
Well, I'm hoping for one thing, that your listeners hear this and think to themselves, I need to go talk to my legislator about how important it is that Oregon does a great job of addressing the affordability crisis through a rent assistance program. We are also working with partners and stakeholders to really think through the remaining questions that do exist, because we definitely didn't attempt to answer all the questions, to figure out what is the right approach for Oregon and how can we go about making that happen.
Okay. Thank you very much for joining us today. Really appreciate it.
Thank you.
That was KBOO's Annette Newell talking to Daniel Hauser with the Oregon Center for Public Policy about their research on how rent assistance could help families in Oregon.
And we have some exciting news, a ticket giveaway for you at this hour. Laugh Lounge partners with All Jane. We'll bring you a sample of some of the best of the fest, both live at Curious, hosted by 2018 All Jane favorites,
The Peterbaugh Sisters, and featuring Maya May, Wally Barham, Sarah Tolomak, Ma Viola, Sherry Hodge, and headliner Emmy Blotnick. So you can have, there's three pairs of tickets that are available. All you have to do is pick up the phone and call us at 503-231-8187. Again, 503-231-8187 at KBOO. For this event at the Curious Comedy Theater starting at 7:30 tonight. We have three pairs of tickets available. You have to call us and give us your name, your phone number, and your email. Again, that number to call is 503-231-8187 for the ticket giveaway for tonight. Well, thanks so much for joining us for the KBOO Evening News and KBOO News In Depth. I'm Annette Newell here with Althea Billings. Thanks for joining us, and stay tuned.
KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Behind the Bullet film screening on Friday, October 4th from 6 to 8 p.m. at the Multnomah Arts Center in Portland. The documentary film Behind the Bullet deepens awareness of untold stories from the U.S. gunfire epidemic. Director Heidi Heumann will be in attendance and answer questions after the film. There will then be a soul box procession into Multnomah Village. Again, that's Behind the Bullet film screening on Friday, October 4th from 6 to 8 p.m. at the Multnomah Arts Center, 7688 Southwest Capitol Highway in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the East Portland Arts and Literary Festival, Friday, October 4th through Sunday, October 6th at FUBON and the Orchids of 82nd Community Space in Portland. The third annual East Portland Arts and Literary Festival features live performances, interactive creative activities, a book and craft fair, and a full family-friendly lineup of artists and cultural workers of color. Again, that's the East Portland Arts and Literary Festival, Friday, October 4th through Sunday, October 6th at FUBON, 2850 Southeast 82nd Avenue, and at Orchids of 82nd Community Space, 8118 Southeast Division.